Money FM 89.3, best of weekends.
Joining us on the line, Steve McGinnis, writer, consultant, and East-West expert. Steve, good morning. And were you surprised to see these IMF GDP predictions?
What's been surprising isn't so much the figures, but in the reaction to the figures and what part of it has got the attention. So obviously the numbers coming out for the West, you know, for Europe, America, Australia, are looking pretty catastrophic. We're looking at between a 5 and 9% GDP drop for those mature economies, which in itself is quite surprising. And that's received a lot of attention. But what hasn't really received as much attention, and I think should be, is the comparative success or continued success of the Asian economies. So whilst you're seeing a huge GDP dip expected in the West, China, Indonesia, India, they were looking at between 1 and 5% growth in 2020. So not only are they not taking the kind of dip, they're not taking the bath we're seeing in the West, they're going to continue to grow. And okay, those aren't the numbers that were expected. You know, they aren't the 8, 9% growth that we're used to seeing in those markets. But when you compare that to the dip in the West and that comparative gap, suddenly you've got a 7, 8, 9, 10% gap between these markets. And that makes the competitiveness and the relationship between the Asian and the Western economies, it really spins it on a pivot. It completely changes the power dynamic.
Talking on the line with Steve McGinnis, a writer, consultant, East-West expert. And Steve, what is to be accounted for this small but meaningful rise in gross domestic product across these countries, like you mentioned, China, India, Indonesia?
Well, there are a lot of economists that would argue that China had eclipsed the U.S. in terms of real economic strength a few years ago, but the deliberate keeping down of the value of the Chinese currency to remain competitive masked that. Now, I think what we're going to see is China emerge as the de facto strongest economy in the world. And I think that whilst you know those who have an understanding of the interrelation understand how much the West is dependent on China, but I would say the layperson in the U.S. or in Europe doesn't necessarily understand how much their socioeconomics are tied up with the success of the Asian dragons and with China. And I think this is going to make it much more apparent when we start seeing businesses that have been looking at Asia as being a production market, you know, somewhere they can get their goods produced cheaply. And suddenly they've got to start looking at it as their prime consumer market. So they're not getting things made in these markets anymore because it just simply won't be economically viable with a weak dollar and a strong yen. They will need to be looking at it as where they're selling their goods, not who's making it. And I think that requires a really radical shift in terms of how the West sees the world and how the West sees its preeminence in the world. And it may not be immediate, but these are the kind of things that I think people are expecting to be seeing over the next 5, 10, 15 years. And it looks like COVID will bring this into sharp relief a lot faster.
It's interesting you mentioned this because I've had a number of guests on the show in recent weeks talking about this idea of regionalization and how you know the U.S. will try to figure out how its supply chain can be closer to North America, you know, whether it's Mexico or Canada or wherever, and how Asia will also look to more importance of the regionalization, the regional groupings like ASEAN and others to provide for needs in this part of the world, so that when the supply chains are inevitably affected, as they have been greatly during COVID-19, that there's a shorter distance to go to get products made and transported. So it sounds like you are in agreement with that will be the new way forward for a lot of countries, not only in Asia, but in the West as well, in North America and Europe.
I think so. But I think the logistics is one element of it. I mean, having the ability to produce your goods or the ability to provide your services is obviously vital. But equally vital is having somebody that can afford to buy it. And if we're looking at a situation where, okay, the governments can pump trillions of dollars or billions of pounds into the economies to pump them up, but essentially that's just printing money. That's not going to increase GDP. It might move more money around to circulation, but that's not going to increase the GDP. It could dangerously impact inflation. So people can no longer afford the goods that they're being given the money to buy. And also, with consumer confidence dropped, if you look at the U.S., you know, how many mortgages are going to be defaulted on? How many companies are going to go bankrupt? I heard that last week, 1 million people in California registered for unemployment. If there is no money to buy these goods and services, there's little point in being able to make them, whether that's a short supply chain or extended supply chain. Where I think the real difference is going to impact on that is, if you need to start selling those products or services beyond your borders, how do you adapt what you're saying about that product? How do you change the messaging? Does a French product still have the appeal because it's simply from France? Does Made in America hold the cachet in the emerging markets that it has done? When is this a market that is still, will it still be looked up to by a lot of these other countries? It'd be interesting to see how people have to perhaps drop some of the baggage of their ways of working, both operationally and logistically, but really how they expect the world to see them and how they expect the world to interact with their products and services as well.
But this has been a challenge for decades, has it not? I mean, you look at products made in the U.S. that were, you know, pricing themselves out of the market. So then they started producing components in China or in Mexico or elsewhere, or the same in Germany, you know, German products that were pricing themselves out. So perhaps they were sourcing things from Poland or, you know, other parts of Europe or even China. So, I mean, this has been a challenge for a long time. And you know, as we move forward, if they do go to a tighter supply chain regionally, you know, how do they manage to, let's say, keep the prices in line in such a way that the goods are going to be appealing to consumers and affordable to them?
You're absolutely right. It's been the magic trick of the last 30 years. We need to be showing constant growth. We need to be getting people to buy more and more goods and services. We need them to buy the same products over and over again. And the only way we can do that is make it at a price that is affordable. When the product itself can't be produced at a viable price for the market, what do? Do you rethink your strategy? Do you rethink how often you buy an iPhone? Do you rethink how often you've got to replace that handbag? No, the magic bullet has been to find somewhere a lot cheaper to make it. And that's now not that box of magic tricks is no longer available now. So people will need to look at how often they can expect people to be replacing products. I read an estimate a few weeks ago that said if an iPhone was actually made in the U.S., they'd be $7,000 each.
I believe it.
You can't then buy one every 2 years when a new one comes out. Do we need to go back to looking at products that are made and last a lot longer, that we don't look at replacing something because it breaks? We don't look at replacing things because they don't work quite as well. And we need to look for that growth that the economy expects somewhere else. And
Of course, that planned obsolescence has been part of a manufacturing strategy for decades now as well. And, you know, interestingly, a couple of years ago, I had a DVD player I wanted to get repaired because it was perfectly good. The optical reader needed to be repaired. And I went to get it called around. It was going to cost $120 to repair that. And of course, you can buy a new one for $95.
Yeah.
a whole new set, right?
And again, you're right. And that planned obsolescence has become the cornerstone of the strategy for a heck of a lot of businesses.
Yeah.
And if you can't expect your revenue to simply be being driven by people replacing the brand they've already bought, where does that come from? And I think when you're looking at the emerging markets, there isn't necessarily in India or Indonesia that appetite to just throw things away because a new one's come along. So that's one my point. I think when it's not just a case of taking the same strategies that worked in the US or the Western or Germany or the UK consumer markets and transplanting that across. I think we need to have a whole new way of viewing it. And I think that requires an understanding of how people around the world outside of the home markets, what they think, what they want, what they value. And that, I think, as much as the logistics gap, that understanding gap is going to be where a lot of the businesses fall down because they simply don't want or don't know what that new target customer wants.
Yeah. We're talking with Steve McGinnis, writer, consultant, East-West expert. And Steve, you know, one of the things that you have talked about in recent weeks is that Western businesses need to reframe how they view Asia. And it's a matter of survival for them to do so. First of all, what do you mean by that? And secondly, if in fact they do need to do that, what are the concrete steps they need to take immediately to make that happen?
Now, that's a very good question. And I think in terms of the level of understanding, the first point is Western businesses need to understand that their worldview is simply a worldview. They need to understand that not everybody around the world sees things, values things, prioritizes things the same way they do. And they need to stop projecting their own assumptions onto the rest of the world. And then simultaneously, they need to stop looking at these other markets as secondary to their home market. When I work with brands, what quite often or almost uniformly, their out-of-home market strategy is a tweak of their home market. So how do they slightly adjust what they're doing and what they're saying for a new market? And I think what we need to do is look at these markets completely fresh. And if look at it in terms of if we were entering these markets with new products, new brands, new services, how would we do it from scratch? Not how do we adapt what we've got?
Do you think Western businesses are really capable of thinking that way, though? I mean, it sounds like the right thing to do, but it somehow seems kind of incredible to me that they would actually think that way.
Well, you're absolutely right. And the very, very difficult bit is that whole line about what got you here won't get you there.
Yeah.
So the way of working that has made these brands successful. So if it's a product that's been talking about its history or talking about its ingredients, or a service industry that's talked about the kind of staff and where they are and what they do, that is built into them. It's what they believe is the most important thing. And it's very hard to let go of something that's worked. It's actually a lot easier to let go of something that hasn't worked. So it's very, very hard for these brands and businesses to drop their armor, to drop the luggage that they're carrying. But the danger is the things that are their greatest strengths at home, if they keep banging on with the same points and keep reinforcing the same messages, they're actually going to be the anchor that pulls them down. It's not a foundation, it's a liability. And whether it's a question of can they or can't they, I think it's really the point is, will they do it and survive, or will they not do it or not be able to do it or not see the need to do it and not survive as their home markets shrink and they fail to leap onto the next ice flow.
Yeah. As companies are now looking forward, planning post-COVID, doing their risk assessment, of course, for their businesses, their supply chains, whatever they do, if they're a manufacturer or if they're a services firm, what practical step would they need to take, next week as they sit down in the boardroom to come up to this idea that you are putting out there about how they need to change their viewpoint, change their relationships with Asia?
Well, there are a couple of key elements that would be done quite simply. The first is to really try and look afresh. One interesting exercise is, if you would be brought into the business as a new CEO after the previous CEO had been ousted, what would you do? If you were given the blank piece of paper that's required to make the radical change that's needed, and you were given the mandate to make that change, what would you do? What would you hold on to? What would you radically change? And coming into that with a fresh piece of paper and a wholly fresh viewpoint. The second is in terms of business growth and business relationships. We have addicted ourselves to quarterly earnings reports. And it's very difficult to make strategic decisions and think long term when we are tied to what is going to benefit us in the next few weeks. Now, the way, in my experience at least, working with Asia, things are a lot more long-term. Decisions aren't made in a heartbeat. Relationships aren't built overnight. So we need to be thinking in terms of longer term, in terms of depth of relationships, both with consumers and with other business partners. And we need to start thinking in terms of how does that new target user use the product? What do they want from the product? What do they want from the service? And similarly, what does a B2B business, what does their customer want, need, respect, value? And just really just shed those preconceptions, look at things afresh, and be open to the idea that there is a new and different world ahead of us is not necessarily a bad thing. It's just different. But that appreciation of those differences, that is the key thing. It is not business as usual.
Steve McGinnis, a business consultant, East-West expert. Thanks so much for being with us today and giving us your views.
Thanks, Glenn.
To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at moneyfm893.sg or download the SBH radio app available on Google Play or the App Store.